Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of March 19th, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers here from Phoenix, Arizona, and I'll be talking to you this week about some of the things that happened in taxes. We'll talk about the IRS ending a program that allowed people to come in from the cold with offshore information that they hadn't quite disclosed. We'll talk about the issues about getting a tax return prepared by your employer and how much of that should be in the W-2 of the employee. We'll also talk about a case that deals with an issue that the tax court labeled a conundrum only a tax attorney could love. We'll deal with that. We'll talk about selling a rental in this case. The IRS issued some long-awaited guidance for many of you that deals with how we're going to report and pay the Section 965 transition tax. And we'll finally look at the taxpayer who was trying to claim a Section 1231 loss on a property that they had purchased with the intent eventually to try to rent, but things didn't quite go right. Let's start this week by talking about that program I mentioned already the IRS was going to be shutting down. The IRS announced that they are going to be shutting down the Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Program on September 28th in News Release IR 2018-52 that was issued on March the 14th. This program is one of the programs the IRS offered that have been offered over the past decade or so related to the ability of taxpayers to come in from the cold, let's say. A lot of this started, you may remember, back when we had the UBS disclosure of information related to various tax, shall we say, hiding systems that were using information involving offshore accounts they had set up. They ended up disclosing information to the U.S. government. That caused a lot of taxpayers to suddenly panic and want to come forward. The Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Program was meant to provide a method to allow taxpayers who, you know, they had that account in Switzerland and they kind of felt that, well, the IRS would never know about it. It's a Swiss bank account, so I don't really need to worry about reporting that income. They allowed you certain ways to get back in the system. Now, the OVDP program, which is how it was referred to, generally the concept there was that you kind of knew you should have been reporting this, but you just hadn't done so. Well, they said, well, we're going to let you back in, but because you kind of knew this was wrong, we're going to force you to pay certain penalties. Now, if you meet the requirements of the program, we'll let you back in. We will not pursue criminal prosecution. Oh, yeah, that's a bit of a problem, but you always have to remember in cases like this, there is a criminal element that could be involved here. Tax evasion is a criminal offense, please remember. And intentionally avoiding your tax responsibility is basically getting to the point of looking like evasion. So that's one of the issues. And initially, they had a lot of people come into the program. In fact, it is raised per the IRS when they posted this announcement. They indicated it raised close to $11 billion over its term. But they've seen a much lower number of people coming into the program in recent years. While it essentially had peaked in 2011 with people coming in, they only had 600 people come into the program. They had a lot more over time. So we're down to very, very few people coming into the program in the last year. So the IRS has decided to announce, basically, this is last chance. On September 28th of this year, the IRS is going to end this program. So if taxpayers have not come into this program by that date, they're not going to be allowed in under this program. Now, there are still ways, obviously, you can try to come in, but you're not going to have any assurance that you will not be subject to the full penalties under the law, nor necessarily will you be assured that you will not face criminal prosecution. You know, all of that has to be part of the deal that gets done. So it's a lot more complicated moving forward, shall we say, dealing with this program. So basically, they're saying, look, if you've been delaying and you thought, hey, I don't know if I should do this or not, I'm not sure if it makes sense, now's the time to make a decision very quickly. Now, the IRS is going to maintain the streamlined filing compliance procedures program. That program is similar in nature, except for this. If you come in under that, you have to be able to show and basically no evidence that says this is wrong, and you basically sign a penalty of perjury that this is correct, that you did not willfully fail to report this information. Basically, it's meant to cover people who just weren't aware, let's say, that they needed to file some of these forms. They legitimately thought that, you know, there was no obligation for filing. That program is still in effect, and you can check it out. It's on the IRS website for all the ways of getting in from an offshore program. But the IRS did note that they could remove that program as well in the future. So, you know, that's one other program that you need to keep your eye on if a client runs into it. Now, remember, that program, because it requires you not willfully avoid filing the forms, kind of the problem you got there is if, you know, a client comes to you and you say, oh, yeah, oh, by the way, yeah, you've got to file this stuff because I don't care that this account is in Mexico or this account is in Japan or this account is in, you know, Venezuela. It doesn't matter. You've still got to report that on your U.S. return, and you've got to file the FBARs and other documents to go with it. If a client does that, once you've told them these things and then they decide not to do it, that begins to look willful again. So yeah, usually got one shot into that. One key warning I'll give everybody here, if you are not an attorney, this is a dangerous area to get near. The problem is a client who starts talking about things that, oh, that account, yeah, I have that account in Switzerland. And, you know, and they start wanting to tell you about what they had over there and how it, you know, what they've been reporting. Be very, very careful. CPAs, EAs, anybody who's not an attorney does not have privilege in criminal matters. And tax evasion is a criminal matter. The problem is if they start telling you what they've done, that information is fully discoverable. By that, I mean, in a criminal investigation, you would have to provide to the, you know, to the investigatory agency, to the government, you could be put on the stand having to testify what the client had told you about this transaction. And that could be a major problem for the client. If any client starts coming to you and you begin to suspect, hey, there's an issue here, strongly suggest if you are not a member of the bar that you refer the client immediately and keep them from talking, shut them up whatever way you can. If you have to leave the room and close the door behind yourself to stop them from talking, stop them from talking and send them to see an attorney who will then clear them as to whether or not they can then come back and talk to you. But be very careful here. But again, last chance, the OVDP program is going to end on September the 28th. Now let's go on to a little different thing. This is, again, we're going to deal with overseas issues again, but this time a little different approach. This is Chief Counsel Advice 2018. 10007 was issued on March the 9th of 2018. And this case involves a company. They had a number of employees that they assigned to various overseas locations. So, you know, they'd hire you, let's say here in Phoenix, and they'd say, oh yeah, we've got you. We need you in Venezuela this month. You know, we need you in Venezuela for the next couple of years. And then maybe they finish that, you know, we finish the work and we decide, oh, well, Venezuela is not what we need you anymore. We now need you in Japan. And maybe a few years later, we need you now in France. So these employees are being sent all over the world. As you're probably aware, that's going to be a much more complicated tax filing situation than had that person just stayed here in Phoenix and worked here just simply inside the U.S. in one state, in, you know, one location, no problem. So what happens in that case is because they have this highly complicated situation, two things end up happening. First thing is they might be disadvantaged because it may be that their income in that other country is going to be taxed at a higher rate than it would have been in the U.S. And secondly, they're going to have to prepare extra tax returns. So what the employer does is the employer sets up, a lot of them do this, a tax equalization agreement. And what they're going to do is they're going to kind of agree to pay the employee an amount so that we're going to adjust their salary when we move them from country to country so that their net, what they get to take home, shall we say, their take-home pay, is going to be the same as it would be had they been working here in Phoenix, let's say in the home office. So we'd be working here in the U.S. in the home office. This is what our tax return would have looked like. This is the net we would have been able to take home. We're going to fix that by by essentially raising or lowering salaries in the foreign country, depending upon how things work, probably raising to pay for that differential. Now, that's all well and good, except there's one problem. I need to know what their tax is, both in the U.S. and overseas. So the employer, in this case, as many of them do, hires an outside firm, quite often, as in this case, an international CPA firm, that'll prepare the return for the employees, and they pay for the preparation because they need to know what those numbers are. So because they're going to use that for the equalization purposes, they pay for all that. Now, this employer had apparently decided, well, okay, employees are getting their tax returns done for free. That's compensation, right? That's something of value. So the employer had reasoned, well, really, what the real value here is the value of what it would have cost them to have their U.S. return done had they not left the U.S. So let's say it would have cost them $300 because it'd been a relatively simple return. You know, they go, they check the places, and they decide, well, it would have been, let's say, $300, whatever that number might be, to do a relatively simple return. You know, go ahead and check, you know, the storefront tax operations, because most of these employees didn't have complex returns at all. They had a W-2. They might have some charitable contributions. A lot of them were standard deductions. So it's, you know, very simple return that could easily be handled by a storefront tax operation. And that's what they probably would have used. So we put that in their W-2. Now, of course, what's really happening is we have here an international CPA firm preparing that return, which, by the way, is no longer quite as simple. Again, it's going to have probably at least a foreign earned income exclusion worked into the program. And then secondly, that international firm is also handling the filings they may need to make in France or Venezuela or Brazil or whatever country they may be in. And then doing the calculations to figure out if the equalization payment worked out right and whether the employee owes the employer money or vice versa, the employer owes the employee money and gets all that to work. And the international CPA firm, you know, they charge the company for lots of things, but the charge just for the tax returns themselves, that there was a way in the agreement that was broken out, is well in excess, as you might come to conclusion, of what they were actually treating as what the storefront would be paid. I don't know if any of you have priced getting tax returns done by an international CPA firm recently. First thing is they don't really do returns that are standard deduction returns for the most part, certainly not standalone. You know, where they're just doing them by themselves. They don't really market to that audience. And secondly, when they do, quite honestly, the payments in question become fairly significant. You know, we're talking about we've got a much larger fee than what you're going to pay going to H&R Block, even if they did the standard H&R Block style return. So the numbers are way bigger. Now, the IRS examined this company for payroll tax purposes, and the examining agent said, well, no, wait, this doesn't make sense. These guys are getting something. And, you know, it's not even just the cost of the employer for the returns, because really, if you just went to an international accounting firm and got this return prepared, you'd be charged significantly extra because the firm admitted that they were giving a volume discount for the number of returns they were doing. So they're saying, really, shouldn't these people be charged much more? The national office agreed with the IRS employees in this case. They said, yeah, you know, the real value they're getting is the value of having an international accounting firm prepare all of these returns. And yes, it's the foreign returns and the U.S. returns. These are obligations of the individual because they are working in those countries. They're not an employer obligation. The employer is taking them on, that's fine, but they're still not an employer obligation. So it's an obligation of the individual. And so they should be charged. And they agreed that while probably the value is more than what the employer is paying, because they pointed out that, you know, it's kind of tough. If you walk down to Deloitte & Touche, you know, and just say, hey, you know, what do you want to charge me for a 1040 EZ? You know, just kind of walking off the street. They're not really marketing to that group. So it's like there's not really a price that can be easily determined as to what the normal, let's say, D&T or Ernst & Young charge is for a 1040 EZ. They're saying, well, because of that, you know, we think the best approximation we really have, even though it's low, is going to be that discount amount that was charged. And they said that's what should be there. Obviously, this is a payroll tax issue, but this does impact people and it does impact companies. So If you have this situation, be aware of the IRS, at least chief counsel advice, that don't try and say, I'm just going to get the value as if they were in the U.S. for a theoretical return. They want to see it tied to the actual. Hey, here we go. This is an interesting case. This is a case, Simonson versus Commissioner, 150 TC number 8 on March 14th of this year. Now, this is a case that has the conundrum that only a tax attorney could love. That will be solved by the tax court. The taxpayers in this case bought a mansion, a seaside mansion in Newport, Rhode Island. They basically, you know, bought it. It had been abandoned effectively for 40 years. So for various reasons, it was not even inhabitable at the time they bought it. They decided that they would, what they're going to do is they're going to restore this mansion. They're then going to be able to rent it. You know, in peak season, like in the summer, they could get $75,000 a month for this place. And even in non-peak season, midwinter in Rhode Island, they could still get, it was projected, $10,000 a month for that mansion. So they thought, well, it makes sense. We'll just bring it back up to spec. We'll repair it all the way back up, and we'll go ahead then and rent this property out. Well, it turned out that, in essence, or I should say, whoops, wrong case. See, this is what happens when you do multiples. We'll deal with the Rhode Island one here a little bit later. This is the case of a property. Now I'll get this one correct. It's really weird. We got two houses this week, and I mixed the two up. This is the Simonson case. In this case, it's a taxpayer that bought a townhouse in San Jose. They then converted that house to a rental when it had declined $200,000 in value. Okay, so they paid $695 for it. Then a few years later, and again, they bought it at the peak of the market just before the crash. And basically 5 years later, they relocated to Southern California. So they started renting this thing out, you know, while they're trying to sell it. And at that time, it had declined to $495,000. Eventually, they were negotiated a sale. And the sale itself, there's a long discussion there. And by the way, the case is interesting for some other issues that come up in this case, including the fact that we have a short sale with a non-recourse debt. And that really plowed no new ground. If you have a short sale with a non-recourse debt, you're still going to treat it just like a foreclosure, where the sales price will be the balance of the debt, not the agreed upon short sale price with cancellation of debt. So in any event, though, we get a sales price now that's in the middle. It's less than the $695, but it's more than the $495. That's a problem. And it's a problem because Code Section 165, the regulations under 165, 1.165-9, tells us that in the case where we have a property that was converted from personal to business use, you know, when we compute, you know, for purposes of computing a loss on disposition, we have to use the lower of the adjusted basis, you know, the cost less the accumulated depreciation of the property, or we have to use the value on the date the property was converted to rental use. Okay, well, let's see. We take the $695, we take off the depreciation, and you know, we're still way above the $555, so that we can't use that. That's not how we compute a loss. So now I put the $495 in, but now I don't have a loss. As the court said, the regulation tells us to use the $695 for computing a gain and use the $495 for computing a loss, but it's totally silent on what happens if we're in the middle. As the court said, that is a conundrum that only a tax attorney could love. And I suppose a few CPAs and EAs maybe will get off on this thing, thinking it's really great. But basically, most other people think that this is just a pain. The court said, let's take a look at a similar rule when somebody gifts property with a fair value less than its basis to the donor. In that case, the reg's very clear. If you sell it for more than the fair value on the donation when it was given to you, but less than the basis of the original donor, then, you know, no gain or loss is recognized. The court said, you know, that seems to be a logical solution. It makes sense. And they said that really is the solution in this case. No gain or loss should be recognized. Now coming up, the IRS outlining how to report and pay the Section 965 transition tax. And either you've been waiting for this with bated breath or you wondered what I just said. But though, if you have any of the people with this problem, you've really been waiting for this. This is News Release 2018-53 and a Q&A, basically a frequently asked questions list on the IRS website that's entitled Questions and Answers About Reporting Related to Section 965 on 2017 Tax Returns. These both came out on March the 13th. The hitch is the initial payment of what's referred to as a 965 transition tax is due on 2017 returns. Roughly, this is that conversion where we're going from the one from the method of taxing foreign income for a foreign subsidiary by worrying about when the money comes back on shore to instead going to a system where we're going to effectively not tax that income for corporations. Now, here's the quirk, though. There is a special transition tax that is to be paid, that is the deemed repatriation, where we're supposed to pay that tax with the return this year. That's all well and good, except it doesn't just apply to corporations. It also applies to individuals, although individuals will not get the benefit of that no tax on the dividends coming from the foreign corporation. That rule doesn't apply. We still keep the same tax rules generally there, but they still have to pay this transition tax. And the entire tax or the first payment, if you make the eight-year election, is due on your 2017 tax returns. Now, that's kind of important because if you take a look at your 2017 tax returns, you'll find there's no place to report this tax. If you take a look at Form 5471, which would be required for, you know, if you own an interest in a corporation that's going to trigger this problem, you're going to file 5471. There's no place on there to report the tax either. There was no place to report the tax. Nowhere it tells you what to do about it. It's like, and we're supposed to file it. And that was a problem because dates are coming up now. They've got to go with the first return. What the Q&A tells us is, first thing they do is they give us guidance on how we're going to report this tax. And if you're waiting for a form, well, it's not really a form. You're going to find out they're going to use PDF attachments. And they have example ones in the Q&A you can link. You'll find in the Q&A, if you click on their links, you'll get their example PDF. I will say the example PDF on how to report for a 1040, get your magnifying glass out if you print it. I would strongly suggest you keep it on you keep it as a PDF on your computer and you read it on the computer, because at least there you can magnify easy, because they have printed in the smallest font possible on that form. But that'll be attached. By the way, you have to attach it to an e-filed return if you e-file, and you have to give the file a specific name. This is kind of interesting. They also give guidance on paying this tax. And interestingly enough, you've got to make a separate payment. Even though it goes with the 1040 or the 1120, the payments are going to be separated into two separate categories. So there's going to be your regular tax payment that goes in, and then there's going to be a whole separate check or transfer that's going to involve paying the 965 tax. So again, dual payment issues are coming up. They tell you how to do that in here. They also tell us about the elections. For instance, the big election, there's a number of elections in this section, but the big one's going to be the election to make an eight-year deferral to pay us over 8 years. That election must be made on a timely filed return. It's got to be on the original return, right on this return, and you know, due by the due date, including extensions of the return, but you've got to get that document in. The way to make that election, again, with a PDF with a specific file name, is given to you as well in this document. Now, a couple things I'll suggest. The IRS, when we talk about the taxpayer advocate, has put her complaints up saying that she's not happy the IRS is using this frequently asked questions method of putting guidance out. The problem she has, which is also a problem I have, is nothing stops the IRS from changing that web page, you know, at any point in time. So even though you may go today and read this guidance, I would suggest that when you actually go to handle a specific return and you're getting ready to hand it to the client, you want to recheck and make sure nothing changes on this page. Because right now, this page is what you need to follow. Hopefully the IRS won't change it. Hopefully it'll make sense. I would also suggest one other thing. When you do lock it down and file based on it, I would suggest using printing to PDF the web page as it exists on the day you actually file the return to show that you filed what was the guidance at that time. Because don't expect to be able to go back a year from now and find a copy of the web page, easily find one that existed on that date. I suppose you go to the internet, to the Wayback Machine, the Internet Wayback Machine site, maybe they'll have it, but you know, it's still a bit of a problem. Finally, the case I mixed up before. This is a case of a client, the Keefe versus Commissioner case, TC Memo case 2018-28, which was issued on March 15th of 2018. This is a case of a client, you know, or a taxpayer, I should say, who purchased that historic mansion in Rhode Island. I mentioned that before. They wanted to restore and rent it. Things didn't go so well in the restoration. Not surprisingly, it cost more and took far longer than they expected. There were lots of issues with the restoration, including illnesses for contractors. I mean, all kinds of things went wrong. This went on for years, and they were unable to rent this mansion during that time. They did, however, contact a real estate agent, and she talked with some of her high-end clients about whether they might want to rent this during the season coming up. And they even had one person that got specifically interested in renting it. But the problem she kept having was she was talking to these people about renting this, but it was always in the future because due to the restoration project going on, it wasn't yet in shape to be rented. As you might expect, if you're paying $75,000 a month to rent a piece of property, you don't really want to have construction workers walking through, you know, constantly and, you know, pounding going on and all those things happening, you know, and, you know, you have the nice smells of paint flat wafting through the building and all the other stuff you would have with the restoration continuing to go on. So not really rentable. Eventually, because of economic problems, the bank, what ended up happening was they were borrowing from the bank to construction loans to keep the restoration going. Eventually, the bank kind of got tired of waiting, and the bank significantly jumped their payments per month. In fact, as I recall, the difference is they went from $25,000 a month all the way up to, in this case, was about $40,000 a month. Significant, and it was significantly more, and it made it much tougher for them to be able to continue to, you know, to handle this house. So they gave up. It was never actually rented. Now, they went and sold the property. They told the person preparing the return about this sale. And the person that prepared the return claimed a capital loss. Now, it is a seven-figure capital loss. As you probably aren't aware, if you don't have some nice big capital gains, the seven-figure capital loss is not going to do you a lot of good. It's going to be coming out on your return at $3,000 a year if you don't have other capital gains to offset it. And it's going to take a while at, you know, a few million for you to be able to recover this. Now, there's some question about the basis, everything. So whether it was a $2 million loss or a $6 million loss, it was still a multiple billion dollar loss. Apparently, after talking to an estate planner, and we don't know if this estate planner was an attorney, was a financial planner. We have no idea what this is. Just an estate planner is all the court tells us. The estate planner apparently suggested to them that, wait, your preparer fouled this up. This should be an ordinary loss, right? And you should be able to generate an ordinary loss and get a benefit from this. So the taxpayers decided, yeah, that's what we should be able to do. Well, the case doesn't tell us if they went back to the original preparer, but we do know they did not use the original preparer to file amended returns. They went and found somebody else. Probably not much of a stretch to discover that the original preparer refused to change the return to, and or at least refused to sign that, you know, refused to change the return because he wasn't going to sign the return to add in this as a 1231 loss. So they found somebody who would. And not only did they have a nice big loss on the year they got rid of the property, but it was 2009. They carried the loss back 5 years and they carried it forward once. They were able to wipe out income effectively for, you know, for 5 years going back, 1 year going forward, and for the year of sale. So, you know, there's 7 years they're not going to pay income taxes on. They got these nice big refunds. course, the IRS then, after issuing the refunds, decided to examine the return, and they came to the conclusion, you know what? That's not a 1231 loss. That's a capital loss. The taxpayers took that to court, but the tax court said, guys, this is not a 1231 loss. The property was never used in a business. Now, you know, they had some other cases they mentioned, but the court said in all the other cases you show us, the property actually was available and open and rented in those cases. And then fine, we got a 1231 loss. But in this case, this property, the rental never happened. The property never converted from a capital asset to an asset used in a trade or business because there was no trade or business ever that actually took place. So because of that, the original preparer had the return right. This is a capital loss. This is not an ordinary loss. And therefore, taxpayers, not only do you owe the tax, but you also owe penalties. This is something we have seen before. The tax court is, and other courts, have been very skeptical of taxpayers who got conflicting advice and then somehow decided that, of course, the one that had less tax was the advice that was the one they really should follow. The court makes it very clear here that if your motivation for choosing between the preparers is effectively, you know, who got me the lesser tax, then you're not going to have reasonable cause. You know, the court wouldn't even need to go to this point as to whether you provided the information to all the parties and you relied upon their advice, etc. No, when faced with conflicting advice, you gave us no evidence that you had somebody look at this. For instance, a reasonable way of dealing with this conflicting advice might be to go find another unrelated professional and, you know, see what they would say maybe about which position they believe is more appropriate. You know, look at those things. You know, I can understand individuals thinking this way because I'm not a tax expert. I don't know. I've got a tax expert here. He claims to be an expert. He says it needs to be this way and I'm going to pay a lot of tax. And I got tax expert B over here who says, no, you report it this way and you get all your money back. Well, they're both tax experts. So, and I'm not an expert. So I'll just go with the one that has less money. That's your problem. And that was a fundamental problem in this case. You have to have some reason other than I'm just going to go with the answer I like as the reason to go with one professional over another. Well, this has been, you know, dealing with this week, looking at the continuing education, and apologize for that little confusion over the case in the middle, but, you know, we'll deal with that as we can. Watch for all these courses though coming up. Speaking of confusion, we're going to have a nice confusing year. We've got the tax year coming up with all the changes in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Be sure to watch for that catalog coming from your state society or going online here shortly about the live courses we have coming up. We're going to be presenting around the country, and your state societies are going to be presenting those live courses where people come to you, and we can actually answer questions and talk in person, which is always a nice way to do it. They'll also be doing a number of the state societies will also be webcasting some or all of their presentations. So you may be able to trigger it from that standpoint, but certainly watch for our cases here coming from those of us who teach the live courses for CAP professional education in the CPE realm. Those of us from the, you know, what we had been in the past, Nichols Patrick and Lascalzo Institute. Now we're going to be just called Kaplan. So get your names right, you know, Kaplan Professional. But check for that. Check with your state society. We're going to be talking to you about ANA and tax issues. Well, as always, this has been the tax update for the week of March the 19th of 2018. Catch our updates during the week at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We'll post there as things happen during the week. If you want to go there too, you can download a PDF that has the articles about the things I talked about here today. You can take a look at that background. Also, by the way, if you go there, you're going to find the link. The links in that PDF, you'll find the links to the IRS's page that talks about the 965 taxes, which I guess is, if you need that, you really need that. You can send any questions or comments to us, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, to let us know about anything, any questions you have about this or comments about the program. On Twitter, I'm at edzollers, and you can also follow my discussions. I participate in the subreddit on Reddit at www.reddit.com/r/taxpros. We have some discussions going there, so you know, any of those places, you can go ahead and try to keep up during the week. With that, hopefully your tax season is going well, and we look forward to seeing you next week, or here you can listen to us next week on the current federal tax developments.